Welcome to the program. I'm Jeff Shechtman. The war in Afghanistan, once referred to as the Good War, is at 16 years and counting America's longest war. In fact, the case can be made that American efforts at disruption in Afghanistan started long before 9/11. In fact, CIA efforts in the country have antecedents as far back as the 1970s. And still, after the loss of 2,000 American lives, countless lives ruined, $4 billion a year to prop up the country, and tens of thousands of civilians killed, we are still no closer to success. 8,400 troops are still in country, and 5,000 more may be on the way, a mere fraction of the 100,000 that were once there. And what do we have to show for it? A failing Afghan government, a tenfold increase in the number of terror groups in Afghanistan since 9/11, and no end in sight. My guest, Matthew Ho, knows all of this only too well. He's a Marine Corps veteran and diplomat who resigned his State Department post in Afghanistan in 2009 in protest over the war. He is currently a senior fellow with the Center for International Policy, and it is my pleasure to welcome Matthew Ho here to Radio Who, What, Why. Matthew, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Jeff. Thank you for having me on.
First of all, tell us a little bit about your experience, both as a Marine and as a diplomat up until 2009 in Afghanistan.
Yeah, sure. Well, I had joined the Marine Corps in 1998, a couple years after college, and I served in a variety of capacities as a combat engineer officer, but also had served in the Pentagon. And it was from the Pentagon that I got a position on a State Department team in Iraq in 04 and 05. And so I got to know people in the State Department. In 06, 07, I commanded a Marine Corps company in Iraq. But during that time, I was also working over at the State Department. So in 2008, as the State Department was looking to expand its presence in Afghanistan, as the United States shifted its focus from Iraq to Afghanistan. And that was a really interesting thing to observe, was that shift in 2008 from the priority of the Defense Department and the CIA and the State Department and everyone else going from Iraq to Afghanistan in the course of a matter of months. I was given the opportunity to join the State Department mission in Afghanistan as a political officer. And so I did that. And I went and got there in April of 2009. But it quickly became apparent to me that any thoughts I had about this war, about us having had learned our lessons about the Obama administration wanting to end the war and get out of the war, general officers like David Petraeus were going to utilize and really act on the understanding that these wars cannot be won militarily. They can only be settled through negotiations and through reconciliation and through political compromise. Like what we saw in Iraq in 07, 08, it lasted up until about 2013 or so, where political compromise between the various groups in Iraq brought the violence down. There are other factors too, but it was primarily the political actions in Iraq that diminished the violence so dramatically after 2007 and 2008. And I thought that's what we'd be doing in Afghanistan, but not long after I was there, I realized that no, that the purpose here is to escalate the war, to win the war for political purposes back home in the United States. And I just couldn't go along with that. I mean, I had gone along with it in Iraq, had really done damage to myself because of that. And as I realized during the course of the 5 months that I was there before I left, that what was occurring in Afghanistan was no different than what had been occurring in Iraq. And I couldn't go along with that. I got along with for long enough. And so, yeah, I resigned in my resignation went through in September of 2009. And, yeah, I came home and I've been working on issues of peace and or anti-war since then.
One of the things that you saw during that period around 2008, 2009, that I gather made it more frustrating for you is that there were opportunities for negotiation. There were opportunities for discussion and dialogue, none of which were taken up.
That's absolutely true. And you can see this in, there's been more reporting on it over the last couple of years. Last December, so about 10 months ago, the New York Times reported that the Norwegians finally started talking about this, that in the years 2007, 2008 into 2009, they were meeting with the Taliban to bring about a peace agreement, a peace settlement in Afghanistan. And the Norwegians actually met with Mullah Omar, who was the leader of the Taliban. And it was a long myth up until just last year that Mullah Omar had never even met with anybody from the West for whatever reason. And here we find out, as the New York Times reported, that the Norwegians were meeting with him. And what the Norwegians, of course, said was that we had to keep this secret from the U.S. because the U.S. had no interest in peace. You saw this as well from the man named Sherrod Copper Coles, who was the United Kingdom's top diplomat in Afghanistan and then became NATO's top diplomat in Afghanistan. And when he resigned over the war, and basically resigned in protest from the U.K. foreign ministry in 2010, I believe, end of 2010, you know, his comments, too, were the United States is not interested in peace in Afghanistan. They're the biggest obstacle to peace. And we saw this over and over again. Anand Gopal is probably the best source. He's a journalist. His book, his book is called No Good Men Among the Living, and is probably the best book about Afghanistan that I can recommend. But he's been in Afghanistan for, and he has worked in Afghanistan for a long time, Anand. And, you know, he has done some of the best work as a Western journalist in terms of showing how after 2001, the Taliban did try to surrender. They tried to surrender many times, and that it was constantly rebuffed. And this is consistent with what I saw there in terms of my position in Afghanistan, being both in the east and in the south of Afghanistan, having contact with people who were interlocutors for the Taliban, who would speak to us and say, look, we want to talk, we want to have, you know, but we don't want this war to go on forever. We don't want our children, our grandchildren to suffer as we've been suffering, but we're not going to surrender. But they were willing to talk. And I mean, this again can be further verified by looking at the media from Central Asia, from Southwest Asia, from the Middle East, through the periods of 07, 08, 09 into 010, where there are near constant references to the Taliban, or statements from the Taliban, to the fact that they are interested in talking. And you contrast this with what you heard from our leadership, what you heard from President Obama or President Bush or Secretary Clinton or Secretary Rice or any of the generals or our defense secretaries, that the Taliban are not interested in talking. And that was not the reality. That's been a lie that has enabled the war to continue. And the main reason being was because both administrations have wanted victory in Afghanistan for what I believe are purely domestic purposes.
How much of the history of American involvement in Afghanistan did you know when you went there? And how much have you subsequently learned, particularly about some of the CIA efforts that went on back in the late 70s and throughout the 80s?
I wasn't as well read or understood as I should have been. And I say that meaning I had read the list of required books or recommended books for State Department and military officers. I've read a lot of the popular books that have been written about Afghanistan from some of the more popular authors like Ahmed Rashid. Mm-hmm. But those were always written through a lens of a Westerner's eyes. And so often what I was reading took September 11th, 2001, as the start date of the war. That's where the big book picked up. And maybe there was some things in a preceding chapter or an intro chapter about some history. But what I had read that was influential to me was reading about the Soviet Union's experiences in Afghanistan. And that's where I primarily understood the genesis of the conflict, understanding how the conflict came about in Afghanistan, what Afghanistan was like prior to the civil war that erupted prior to the Soviet Union's entrance into Afghanistan or invasion of Afghanistan in December of 1979. But while I was there in Afghanistan, I worked very closely with the governor of the province. I used to eat lunch or have dinner with him every day. We lived across the street from each other, basically. My job was to be his advisor. The governor had read most of these books that were recommended reading for Americans in Afghanistan. And he was very critical of them. And he had spent a lot of time in the West as well. And his view was basically, if I gave you a 300-page book to read about the United States that only encompassed the last several years, why would you think that would be of sufficient, provide with a sufficient knowledge to operate here politically and understand the conflict that's going on? And that really struck me. And so I didn't read as much local Afghan or Central Asian sources as I should have, and it was a very good learning experience. But there was also a book too that I found while I was there, and I think his last name was Griffith. The book was called Reaping the Whirlwind, and it was written in 1996 or 1997, shortly after the Taliban came to power, about the rise of the Taliban by a man who is in Afghanistan, I believe he was British, if I recall correctly, who was there as an aid person. He was working for an NGO doing humanitarian work. And that book really helped me to understand the conflict in its current form through the eyes of someone who was there prior to 2001. And I read that book almost nearly as soon as I got there. I just happened to stumble upon it on one of our bases, just kind of laying around. And that book really helped. And so I started looking at the conflict, erasing 9/11 from my mind with the conflict and looking at the conflict as a whole, looking at history as having no start date, no arbitrary beginning. And that really helped me understand that the conflict in Afghanistan was this civil war that goes back to the 70s. And just as importantly, understanding what Afghanistan was like prior to the start of that civil war, when there was a period of about four decades of peace in Afghanistan. And so having that understanding really did help me better understand what was happening in Afghanistan and how impossible the American idea of winning in Afghanistan was, using the term winning as American generals or politicians would use it in terms of military, defeating the Taliban, getting the entire country to form under one government that is propped up and sustained by an outside power, realize it's just not possible.
One of the points you've made is that there's certainly winning going on economically, that there's a lot of people making a lot of money in all of this.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually have been all morning reading about drug production, illicit drug production around the world, and certainly the Afghan drug trade. Is well known, well understood. It's massive. The Taliban have reduced it to barely zero. Again, we have to understand and realize that there was no opium or poppy cultivation in Afghanistan prior to the Afghan civil war. So prior to the 70s, there was not much cultivation there of illicit drugs. And it's the civil war. It's the CIA combined with the Pakistani intelligence services who first start producing these encouraging the production of these poppy fields, and then the which become opium and heroin and other drugs in Pakistan. And then that shifts into Afghanistan at some point in the 80s and early 90s, and Afghanistan becomes the largest poppy or opium producer in the world. The Taliban stopped that for a bit of time, but then as soon as 2001 happens and the Taliban are out of power, production goes right back to where it was, and now it's every year there are record crops of poppies, which produce, you know, again, the opium and the heroin and everything, in Afghanistan, the exception being last year or in 2015 when there was a decline due to reasons regarding weather and I think some blight and some other naturally occurring reasons. But no, so you have the United States has spent about $8 billion a year or $8 billion total since 2001 trying to stop the drug production in Afghanistan. But every year, again, there are record crops. And now Afghanistan has, depending upon who you speak to and who you look at, anywhere between 70 and 90% of the world's opium production. And you look at that and the amount of money being made off of that. And same time, too, we lie about that. We say that poppy production, that opium production is what the Taliban do. But that's a lie. Now, I'm not going to say the Taliban's not involved in production of it. They certainly are. And they certainly tax the drug trade where they can. The people who control the drug trade in Afghanistan, the people who have profited the most from the drug trade in Afghanistan, and this is about a $2 to $3 billion a year industry in a country that has no industry. Remember that according to the United States Senate and according to the Special Inspector for Afghan Reconstruction, about 90% of Afghanistan's GDP comes from outside support from other countries, particularly the United States. So that $2 or $3 billion makes this the biggest, most profitable industry, the only industry, again, really, in Afghanistan. And the people who benefit from this are the people who are in the Afghan government. They are the warlords. They are the militia commanders. They are the generals, and they are the politicians who run the Afghan government, who we have been working with, and we have put in power and kept in power since 2001. On the other side of the planet, back here in the United States, the defense corporations have made so much money off of this. You're looking at about $800 billion spent on the Afghan war since 2001, and that's only direct costs. And that doesn't break out the costs that doesn't exclude the fact that the Pentagon's base budget, so the non-war specific costs, so the training of soldiers, the buying of ships and planes and tanks and that kind of stuff, has basically doubled since 2001. So these wars have been a windfall for the defense and intelligence companies, making record profits. Their CEOs make $15 or $20 or $25 million a year, and this in turn allows for an area, say, like Washington D.C., to have. And again, look, depending upon which survey you look at, which magazine, whether it's Fortune or Money Magazine or whatever you look at, the Washington D.C. area to have 5, 6, or 7 of the wealthiest 10 counties in the United States. In terms of salaries, in terms of household wealth, because people are making so much money off of this, not just the CEOs, but the people who work for the defense corporations are, you know, making six-figure salaries simply because they possess security clearances. So the war, like I think all wars, has been a bonanza for a variety of interests, the drug interests, as well as the defense and intelligence company interests. But other than that, it's hard to find or pick out someone else who has benefited with the exception of, some of these extremist jihadist terror groups that have been able to utilize the American presence in Afghanistan, as well as other places around the world, to justify their actions and recruit more followers, recruit more foot soldiers, recruit more people to support them. And this is particularly important when it comes to where does, Taliban's not getting their money from the drug trade. Well, they get it from primarily, they got a lot from the Pakistanis, and a lot of that money actually came from us. However, they get most of their money, and this is what we knew in 2009, most of their money or plurality of their money comes from wealthy donors in the Middle East, particularly Saudi Arabia or Kuwait, who support this cause of theirs, fighting the Americans in Afghanistan.
One of the things that we've seen is the tremendous increase in the number of terror groups in Afghanistan, from just the Taliban that was there in the beginning to dozens and dozens of groups now.
Yeah. I mean, if you know, Jeff, if you want the simplest metric to understand how the American war in Afghanistan has failed, if you're going to say the purpose was to fight terror groups and to stop the spread of transnational terror or extremist groups, in 2001, the United States had only Al-Qaeda listed as a terror group in Afghanistan. And if you want to combine the Taliban with that, that's, you can do that as well. And now, as General Nicholson, who is the commander of American forces in Afghanistan, testified earlier this year to the U.S. Congress, there are now 20 terror groups or extremist groups, or however you want to describe them, operating in Afghanistan. So, I mean, and we've seen this in a sense of as well, too, with in 2001, when we know because the FBI seized documents in Kabul. We know from journalists, Peter Bergen. We know from people who've left the FBI who were very much involved in counterterrorism, like Ali Soufan, that during 9/11, in September of 2001, the strength of Al-Qaeda was between 200 and 400 people. That was it. And now there is this organization that spans throughout the world, as well as similar organizations or other types of organizations, plus the Islamic State, which didn't exist until, the American actions in the Middle East. So we really have to understand that look, and Al-Qaeda had been active. It wasn't like Al-Qaeda had just been created in 2001. Throughout the 90s, they had declared war against the United States. They had declared war against against Middle Eastern governments. They had, they had a whole litany of attacks on targets, American targets or Saudi Arabian targets, or, throughout the Middle East. And again, at this point in 2001, they've only got a few hundred people total. And one of the reasons I think you can say is, and those 19 people they used, well, for the hijackings, well, they used 5 or 10% of their force for that. But now again, like we look at it now, 16 years later, and you see what has happened in Syria, what has happened in Libya, their ability to recruit online, motivate people. And what we find, and there is another report backing this up and verifying it, that this understanding of why people join these groups is really becoming just rote. It's so well documented, even though our politicians in general say another thing. The United Nations just did a study in Africa, and they find that the people who join the militant groups in Africa, like Al-Shabaab in Somalia, Boko Haram in Nigeria, or Al-Qaeda in North Africa, up in Libya and that area, more than 75% of them join these groups because they've had somebody in their family, in their village, a relative, somebody killed by the government. So they join these groups as a way of fighting back. And we've seen this over and over and over again. And so we've had if you're going to state that the purpose of the United States in Afghanistan has been, and in the Middle East, has been to fight terror, well, you have to really accept the fact that it's been a colossal failure.
And it's been a failure on every level, even in terms of the Afghan police and the Afghan army, and that's been a failure as well.
Yeah, you know, and it's such a failure that the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction, guy's name is John Sopko, who's just done incredible work. I think years from now we'll look back and we'll say who had integrity or in his peering, and Sopko is one of them. Really doing, him and his people are doing great work, going against the grain. But his report, the Special Inspector General's office puts out reports once every quarter, and the main headline out of this latest report is that the United States, the Pentagon, is no longer going to release the numbers of Afghan soldiers, of Afghan police, not going to release how many Afghan soldiers or police have been killed or have been wounded or have deserted. They're going to classify all that information. Now, as Sopko says, as John Sopko says, you know, we've spent $120 billion on development in Afghanistan since 2001. 60% of that has gone to the military or the police. So what you're talking about, what, like 70 some odd billion dollars of American taxpayer money. And now the Pentagon is going to say, we can't tell you this information any longer. And the reason being, of course, Jeff, is because the war is going so badly, has been going so badly, that they just don't want this information out there any longer. In terms of the number of Afghan soldiers and police being killed, every 6 months when that number would be reported, it'd be a record on the previous number. The number of casualties, as well as, too, the number that are deserting. We see the desertion rates up to one-third of the force deserts. And we see about, the last figures I saw were from August, but 33 Afghan soldiers and police were being killed every day in Afghanistan. So at best, if you want to call it a stalemate, you can, but they really are losing, particularly when you look at the investment that the United States has put into them in terms of the amount of American lives that have been lost, amount of Americans who've been wounded, and the amount of money we've spent doing this with the purposes, again, or the strategy, I should say, since 2009 in particular, being we're going to train them, the Afghans, and they're going to be able to fight on their own and, you know, defeat the Taliban. And now it's going so poorly that the American government won't even tell you how many Afghan soldiers there are. And this reminds me very much of what happened in 2013, when the war was going so badly in Afghanistan. Every quarter, the Defense Department has to submit a report to Congress. And in that report, they used to include the number of attacks launched by the Taliban, the number of roadside bombs that they had put in the ground, the number of attacks on bases. And in 2013, after they were caught, after the Pentagon was caught lying about it by either the Associated Press or Reuters, the Pentagon stopped publishing that information, because every time they published it, it was getting worse. Every time they published the information, there had been more attacks than last time. The Taliban was stronger than last time. They were more effective than the last numbers. And this, of course, ran against the narrative that we were winning in Afghanistan, that our actions were being successful, that we were on the right path. And similarly, there was another period of time prior to that, a couple years before that, where they used to publish, the Pentagon used to publish in the same report, used to publish information on political control. They would do assessments and who controls what part of the territory in this province, how much control does the government have. They would get into specifics about it. Does the population lean in support of the government or lean in support of the Taliban? And by some point in 2010, they stopped publishing that information after publishing it for only a year or two, because the information was so negative, because the information showed that the Taliban controlled so much territory and the government was so unsupported in large parts of the country, that it was a public relations disaster to have that information being publicly released.
Where does ISIS fit into the equation in Afghanistan right now?
Well, you know, ISIS is a pretty interesting story in Afghanistan, and this comes to us from the folks at the Afghanistan Analyst Network, and they are Afghan-based. They're about one of the best sources of reporting and journalism and research available, and they are very objective. But about 2017, so about four or five years ago, the Afghan Intelligence Service, the NDS, along with the American Intelligence Service too, started paying Pakistani Taliban and Afghan Taliban members to fight against the Taliban. The idea being that you would cause such disarray, you would cause a split in the ranks, you cause all kinds of friction, and it would hurt the Taliban. Well, that didn't really work. And when the NDS and the CIA stopped paying these guys, kind of dropped them, you know, dropped their support of them, well, you had these men who were still committed to fighting, who were still committed to whatever cause they were following, being Pakistani and Afghan former Taliban members. What they did, and they were in Afghanistan at this point, and what they did was they just rebranded themselves. They remarketed themselves. They started calling themselves the Islamic State in Khorasan, Khorasan being a reference to an end of times prophecy in Islam about a Muslim army coming from the region that was then known as Khorasan, which includes Afghanistan, in an end of times battle, basically. So they rebrand themselves, like really smart marketing, because at that point, 2014, 2015, you know, into 2016, the Islamic State is on the rise. And if you call yourself some name in Pashtun or in Urdu or in Arabic or in Dari or whatever that people in the West don't understand, you don't get much attention. But if you call yourself the Islamic State, then you get on the front page of the Washington Post, then you get on the front page of the New York Times, and you start to attract real attention, as well as, too, it's they're hoping to tap into the financial support that comes with the name Islamic State. Again, from those wealthy donors in the Middle East, particularly Saudi Arabia, that provides so much of the financing for these various armed militant jihadist groups around the world. So, so they're not really the Islamic State per se. It's not like a bunch of Islamic State fighters from Syria or Iraq got onto a bunch of planes and flew to Afghanistan and are now there. No, these are guys who've always been there, who actually kind of came together as an organization because of a failed plot by the Afghan and American intelligence services, and then simply just rebranded themselves as the Islamic State. And, you know, got the attention they're seeking. And, of course, now they're getting, because of that, they've been attacked quite a bit by the American and Air Forces. But there was a period of time several years ago, and this is documented. This is, you can see this in the New York Times from a number of years ago, actually, where these men were not being touched by the Afghan army. And so they were, again, they were trying to split the ranks of the Taliban. But no, that's how the Islamic State has come to be in Afghanistan.
And finally, Matthew, what is your sense of why the war even continues at this point?
No one's willing to admit defeat. The war continues for a variety of really tragic, awful reasons. But I think people who can see these reasons in history, it continues because a lot of people are making money off of it. I mean, it's been so profitable. Again, we were talking about the drugs. We're talking about the defense industries. You know, I mean, giving example, using the numbers from the Congressional Research Service, you know, for each of the four. So President Trump, back in the late summer, when he announced his policy in Afghanistan, and the numbers are going to be about 4,000 troops are supposedly going to go there. A lot of people said, well, 4,000 troops is not a lot. But again, using the Congressional Research Service reports, you know, for each of those troops, you can expect 2.5 contractors now to also be utilized. And that turns out, and then also, too, if you look at in terms of how much money the war costs, and we're spending about $45 billion a year in Afghanistan just on direct costs. So the cost for the bombs drops, the cost for the fuel for the planes, the cost of the food to feed our soldiers there, that kind of thing. So by using that rule of thumb of how much it costs to support the war, you see you're looking at anywhere for 4,000 more soldiers going, being $10 to $15 billion more a year in Afghan war costs. I mean, it's simply astounding. But, I mean, you have other issues, too. You have a civil war that's been going on for decades now. It's been going on since the late 70s. So there's no attempts at reconciliation, which is what you need to bring about any peace. There's been you have a government in Kabul that is illegitimate. I mean, the three national elections in Afghanistan that have been held since 2009 have been incredibly fraudulent. I mean, just glaringly fraudulent. So it's amazing. And so as long as you have a government in Kabul, a government that is profiting, that is made up of the people who are profiting rather than of the people who are suffering from the war, this war is never going to end. The Taliban, of course, are fighting because the bulk of them, the masses of them, are fighting because they are occupied or because of grievances, or because they had a relative killed by the Afghan government or the American military. I mean, there's lots of reasons. Not very many of them actually fight for out of religious jihad or any of that kind of thing. So until you have a government that is composed of the people who are actually suffering and hurting from this war, and a policy that is aiming to achieve reconciliation as opposed to victory, and as long as people are making lots and lots and lots of money off of this, you know, Jeff, I just don't see it ending anytime soon.
Matthew Ho, I thank you so much for spending time with us here on Radio Who, What, Why.
Oh, thank you, Jeff. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Scheckman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.